Zest.
You forgot already.
Oh, I forgot to do my zest test. Are we still doing that? Are we still talking about zest?
I thought it was our thing now.
It is our thing. If you want to hear more about zest, you need to join the Patreon.
You do.
Hi. So here we are. We're still zest is now how we test our recorders, apparently.
Mm-hmm. Zesting. 1, 2, 3. Right.
I thought I saw a 2020 thing about zesting. I thought that was like some cult thing.
Ah.
No?
Yeah. No, you're thinking that's the thing that the teens do behind the dumpsters.
Yeah. Wow. Oh, we have too many topics for too many different podcasts is what this comes down to.
Pretty much.
Yeah. Something smells funny there.
Nice.
Was that good? Come on.
I'd like to see how you see what you did there. Yeah.
Yep. So we're going to talk about smells and tastes. Well, I think we need to explain how we even stumbled upon this topic.
Well, it's pretty easy. You opened your mouth and I shoved your own foot in
it. I defend my responses, especially based on the research, the piles of research you gave me for this recording. I think that the things I said made all the sense in the world. So we're, of course, on the Discord chit-chatting about beer we're drinking. And again, if you're not on the Discord, then you need to get on the Patreon. So we're on Discord. And what did I say that it... James, you had sent me a bunch of beer. And we have a little Pony Express thing going on right now. Our wives are getting together midway between our two homes, so they are ferrying beer back and forth.
Yeah, beer mules.
Yep, beer mules. The wifey express, I call it. Mm-hmm. They don't like that.
No.
They do not like that. And as a, I assume, gag, in with all the good beer, you added some pastries because...
Some big lactose bombs.
Yeah, lactose bombs. Because you know that, one, I can't stand them in concept, never mind in taste. And two, you also know that I will very rarely pour a beer out, that I'm willing to try anything.
Yeah.
So you took advantage of that.
Yes, of course, as I want to do.
Mm-hmm. And I made a comment that you could smell the sugar, and I believe I said at one point that I was going to eat a handful of gummy bears to bring down the sugar level in my bloodstream. Like that's right, how much sugar was going on. But I mentioned that I smelled the sugar, and you said sugar doesn't have a smell.
Nope.
And my response was, well, haven't you ever walked into a Krispy Kreme before? Because to me, that's the smell of sugar. Now, due to the, 70 pages of reading you sent me, I now know that that's typically vanilla.
Uh-huh.
But your follow-up question is what really got this going. You said, well, what does salt smell like? And I didn't, honestly, I didn't even have to think about responding to that. I wrote back, it's the ocean. That's what salt smells like to me. And I know salt does not have an aroma, but it got us to talking about aromas and flavors and tastes and how all of that gets intermingled. And if you don't think about it, if you think about sensory as one combined thing, as multi-sensory flavor perception, I believe is the phrase.
Correct.
You do, it's very easy to mix all those things up. After doing all this reading, and we'll get into some of the details, what I love about this is that the fact that hops are used for aroma, it's you're very intentionally creating a multisensory experience and infusing things into aroma that you can't get in taste necessarily.
I would agree with that. Well, so plucky debate was around, well, sugar, i.e. sucrose, is a colorless crystal. It's odorless. It has no aroma. And people say, well, baloney, I can stick my head in a sugar container and I can smell sugar. Sugar smells like something. It doesn't, right? What is happening when you're sniffing this, what amounts, it's a crystal, it's a solid, that even when it turns into, it doesn't turn into a vapor. It doesn't turn into it's not a gaseous form such that it interacts with your olfactory cells. It's a what amounts to a irritant that stimulates this other sensory process called the trigeminal system. That's the nervous system response that's responsible for like capsaicin and hot peppers and black pepper. It's an irritant. So that's what sugar does when you're smelling it. And that response that you're having, your body doesn't necessarily, your brain doesn't necessarily know how to interpret it. So it interprets it as an aroma because that's the cells that are being stimulated, but it's not an aroma. So therefore you can't smell sugar. So eat it.
Krispy Kreme.
Yeah. But as we talked about not too long ago, retronasal versus orthonasal. If we took taste out of it, just whether you're smelling it through the front of your nose or up the back of your nose makes a difference. And why is that? And it's, well, because you have another sensory input when you're, quote, smelling something or sensing something retronasally, which is your mouth. Even if you're not paying attention to the taste, you have other physical characteristics like body, right, and mouthfeel, and carbonation. And CO2 actually is another one of those chemicals that stimulates this trigeminal system.
Mm-hmm. And there are physical stimuli. There are that have nothing to do with the taste receptors. Temperature.
Yeah.
Temperature has an impact.
Exactly. So all those things come together. We talk about beer sensory. This is anything that you put in your face to eat, consume. You have this, but beer is extremely complex. Even if you took the hops out of it, it's extremely complex because of all the malt components and the yeast components. Just those two things alone have an incredibly complex mixture. And then you go and add something like hops. And you add a flower that has 4 to 450 identifiable aroma compounds. That's just the identifiable ones, as well as some of these other chemical attributes that stimulate some of these other sensory responses. How can anyone be expected to, as a, let's say, a novice sensory person, how could you be expected to pick apart some of these nuances? You couldn't.
And there's something to be said for just enjoying the ride.
Absolutely. And that's why we're all in it. But then it inevitably, what I found anyway, is when you get like-minded people together that are, you know, really focused on a single topic, like let's say craft beer and that experience, they've got someone around them or in their group that's got some technical prowess. They want to know more, right? They want to start deep diving because it's fulfilling, right? They're really engaged by that. But you very quickly dive into a very murky world where unless you are in it, it's like, well, whatever, I'm just going back to drink beer again.
Right. And you know, it's a very interesting, one of the things that was brought up in one of these articles, and we'll put all of these on the website in the resources section when we post this episode. But in one of those articles, it talked about the fact that some people have much more sensitivity, whether it's from an aroma perspective or from a taste perspective, to be able to tell these things apart. And that's separate from those that have the training to do so. And the difference between those two things is the training allows you to put words around it. It's about, mm-hmm. It's not so much about, oh, you know, I've been trained to the point where I can tell this versus this. No, it's more that you know how to describe it better. We've said this many, many times, that there aren't enough words in the English language to properly describe all the different flavors and tastes and aromas that are out there. We are not communicative enough to actually make it make any sense.
And there's a phenomenon around when you ask someone to describe something where you don't give them enough categories or make it distinctive enough to allow them to distinguish between things. It's called halo dumping. And basically halo dumping is in a survey like that where you don't have enough categories to differentiate your experience, you kind of start to guess. Mm-hmm. and you really cloudy the data. So people might think that, oh, well, I don't want to ask too many different, I don't want to have too many different characteristics. And you've heard me talk about like the aroma wheel for hops.
Right.
And it's like 12 different or 15 different aromas. That's bullshit. It's way too many. Right. But five is way too few. Because you're like, well, it really doesn't fit there. Kind of fits here. I don't know. Citrus. or pine. Because you get overwhelmed by the sensory input and you don't have the words or enough leeway to fit it into that. So it's called halo dumping. And it makes sensory scientists bonkers because it totally screws up the data.
Oh, I can imagine. You know what I know drives you crazy? When I taste something, I can't place it or I don't particularly like it. And then I followed up with, oh, you know, I did just eat a whole bunch of chips and salsa. You know, I think it was, what was it last time? It was lemonade. I'd had some lemonade and like half an hour later I had a beer. I'm like, this doesn't taste right. Well, moron, you know.
Duh.
Yeah. Yeah. But that's, yes. So halo dumping, that's an interest. That's a new term for me. That's interesting.
Halo dash dumping. It's specific to, well, that whole idea that you're not giving enough categories or a broad enough palette in which to describe your experience. Hmm. And the degree to which something, the data are, quote, dumped there's an equation for it, at least a probability equation for it, that if you've got this kind of complexity and you don't have this enough categories to describe it, your likelihood of having data erroneous due to halo dumping to be X percent.
Huh.
Mr. Statistics.
Yes. Yeah. I've never heard that. You know, I've never heard the term before, but I get where it came from. The halo concept of it. Very interesting. It's making my mind wander into different areas now, but yeah, that is a very interesting term.
That's the preface for this whole discussion, right? So it took us 12 minutes to preface what we're going to talk about. Right. Today.
Well, they had to know the Krispy Kreme, you know, example. So.
Yeah. Right. So where do we want to start here? Because I found loads of articles, peer reviewed articles, and I sent you three.
Yes. You sent me three. They I took so many notes because they were so interesting, but. I can just start throwing some thoughts at you from some of the things that I read.
I'm just thinking from a high level. One of them I sent you was confusing flavor and taste.
Yes, that was the one that that was the largest one,
the long one,
and probably the one that I found the most interesting, the complicated but interesting.
Yes. Yep.
And
it's almost like a metadata research, mm-hmm. almost, because they're looking through and trying to figure out where this whole idea of, well, 80 or 90% of taste is aroma, or and like, where the hell did that come from?
Right.
Nobody knows.
and taste.
When they do try and point out where they found somebody who said it somewhere in a paper, there's absolutely no data behind
it. Right. Well, one of the other articles that you sent me was completely about the fact that it's generally cited that somewhere between 75 and 95% of taste comes from aroma. But that's the paper I was talking about.
But no
one's ever actually proven any of that. That paper was less about, I think, aroma and taste and flavor and more about bad practices of writing technical papers.
Well, that, and to your point, how we describe things.
Yes.
That's what it was all about, is like, how do we put into words what we're smelling, mm-hmm. what we're experiencing? It doesn't have to be smell, but...
Yep. There are so many ways that other one, the longer article, really tried to get into what taste and flavor mean. And what I kept on looking for, and I never got it, was something that told me that one or the other was higher on the segmentation scale. So is flavor a sub-segment of taste, or is taste a sub-segment of flavor? And the answer is no, neither of those things is true. They are two different things.
Right. There's a taste, flavor, trigeminal, and odor descriptor chart in that paper on page 17, mm-hmm. that puts taste and flavor in the same similar groups, taste as being a subset of flavor.
It's kind of like a Venn diagram that got kicked in the NADS, basically.
Pretty much, yeah. So you've got, you know, bitter, sweet, sour, salty, umami and metallic as a taste, because, and I think any sensory scientist that you talk to about taste is going to defer to taste as a physiological response.
Mm-hmm.
Because we can map certain nerve endings to these different stimuli. And that's how it works. If you excite this nerve ending with salt, it fires. But if you excite this other nerve ending with salt, it doesn't. But if you excite that one with something that is sweet, it will fire. So there's a very distinct physiological response. And flavor is more of the psychobiological aspect of taste sensory experience.
I think that makes a lot of sense. One of the citations in this paper was from I'm laughing because people's names are funny, from a scientist named Nuds in 2004. And what he said was, when asked, people will tell you that taste is the sense that gives rise to the perception of flavor.
Yeah.
And I think that's exactly what you just said.
Because you could have something that tastes, you can say it's sweet, it's sour, ooh, it's salty. But what is fruity?
Mm-hmm.
Is fruity a taste? Or fruity a flavor? Well, physiologically, there is no taste bud for fruity. So those complex descriptors have a lot going on there that have a lot of lead-ins from the odor and aroma characteristics, as well as from the taste sensation and that psychological interpretation that we call flavor. All those things come together to say, to call something musty.
Yeah. So often to me, flavors are descriptions that are just pointing you at something else. Well, it's like this, you know.
We use metaphors and similes because we don't have the words.
We don't. It's like trying to explain color to a blind person.
Right. It's a sensory experience that you're having. I don't remember exactly which one of those articles it was, but it was talking about you're getting all these electrochemical inputs from your senses. You know, that's how our senses are sort of the wet wire that we have into the world from between our psychological world and the real world, right? Mm-hmm. So between our brain space and what my wife calls meat space. as opposed to like cyberspace, right? It's meat space. It's for real, right? So that's how we perceive our world. So your perceptions and my perceptions, although the stimuli are working through similar physiological channels, how it's being interpreted psychologically can be completely different.
Yep.
So how I describe a hop aroma and how you describe a hop aroma without a common set of rules and language could be totally different, but yet the same.
Sure.
So weird.
It is weird. It's completely weird. And frustrating when you're trying to have a conversation around it. And of course, it's compounded by the fact that tastes and smells are... Some people like certain ones and some people don't. It's not like you're describing a sensation. You know, if something's hot, you know, oh, I don't like that. It's too hot. No, it's hot. But some people will like a fruity flavor, others won't. And even that is going to color their description of it and how they describe it and the intensity in which they believe they're receiving it.
Right.
So there's so much, what's the word I'm looking for? It's pejorative to a degree.
Yeah. Yeah. Everything we've said is what really stimulates me about this whole topic of the sensory experience, as it relates to beer, but also to fruits and other horticultural products. But there's so much there to unpack. It's just fascinating that we can have such different perceptions from, you know, psychological perceptions of the same chemical stimuli.
Yep.
And but yet, how do we find a common language to agree upon whatever that said stimuli or beer or hop is? So I don't hold it against anybody. You know, some people are like, well, what do you mean you can't taste this in there? How do you mean this doesn't smell like this? What's wrong with you? Because your perception is different. That's why I generally go to the chemistry. Mm-hmm. Because that doesn't change. That's not subjective.
And we're getting better about common terminology. I mean, we came up with hazy, so we're getting somewhere.
Ah, yes. Hazy is also not a flavor. Yes, I know. Or a taste. I'm sorry. Or an aroma. Hazy describes visual, is a visual descriptor.
For any of you playing at home with the bingo card, I just got a point. So.
Yes, you did. You did.
Oh, I love it.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's so much here, and we're not going to do any of these articles justice, except the goal here is to get you interested enough to read them.
That's exactly what it is. So let's take it. Oh, I'm sorry.
No, go ahead. Go ahead.
I was going to say, let's take a different tack on this, right? So it's not just about, you know, what is physiologically a taste versus psychologically a flavor, or how does aroma impact our perception of a taste response.
So that's, I happen to be looking right at, you know, again, some of these one-liners from the articles really just made me sit back and think. And when you talk about aroma, one of the things that that came up was the idea that flavor is its own sense, its own distinct sense from everything else, but it's one that is cognitively constructed from the sensory systems, the physiological sensory systems of taste and of smell. And those two together combine to give you flavor. So you don't have flavor receptors per se, but you have taste and aroma receptors that matrix those together into a flavor, which I thought was fascinating.
Mm-hmm. I totally buy that. It's like, excuse me, how you said, you know, describe color to a blind person. Well, it's like saying, tell me what color that collage is. Well, how can you do that? And so that's how I think of hops. Hops are a collage of multi layers of aromas and flavors. So how can you describe it as dank? But yet we all know what dank is because it evokes an image in our mind that is constructed as a collage of lots of different things. Mm-hmm. So that's how that works. It's why that works. I don't like it. But, you know, welcome to my life.
We try so hard to make sure you like everything.
Oh, isn't a day goes by where I don't say, boy, they worked really hard to make sure I liked everything today.
Oh, my.
Anyway, I wanted to talk about one of these other papers, right? So it's called Confusing Taste and Smells, mm-hmm. How Odors Can Influence the Perception of Sweet and Sour Tastes.
Yep, I've got the box plot charts in front of me. So interesting.
Yep. And so you've got, now we're talking taste, and we're talking physiological taste bud response. So it's sweet or it's sour, right? So we just heard me say, we have these nerve endings that trigger for these different taste stimuli, right? Mm-hmm. But how does odor impact our perception of that stimuli, sweet or sour? I'm not going to lie, I got goosebumps right now because this paper is just so well, this project is so well done.
Oh, yeah. Just we've talked about the scientific method and about measurement, and we've reviewed papers before that we've said there are holes here or things they could have done differently. They just hit everything right on this one.
Mm-hmm. So good. You want me to describe this, or you want to describe it?
I'll give it a shot, and you'll correct me.
Okay, how's that sound? Right. No? Okay, sure.
But yeah, they looked at, in particular, and I'll have some questions for you too. They looked at several different odors, different kinds of odors. They worked with food odors, with non-food odors, and they had the subjects drink like a sucrose solution, I believe.
Just, yep, just straight up sucrose mm-hmm. solution. No flavorants or nothing. Yep.
And they had them rate how sweet it was depending on what the odor was that was going along with it. And sure enough, things like strawberry, caramel, made them perceive that the sucrose was sweeter. They also had other things that made them downplay the sweetness. And I you know, is it eucalyptus, I think, was one of those things in there? Eucalyptol. Yeah, menthol.
Yeah, menthol.
And it just incredible that they were able to use the odors to very specifically push the sweetness up or down, the perception of sweetness up or down, for the same foods.
Yep. Total same sugar concentration. So you could put that in a Brix meter. They did strawberry, I can't have my glasses.
Yeah, maracuja?
That's passion fruit.
Okay. Then maltol?
Menthol. Is that maltol?
Maltol, yeah.
Yeah, maltol. I thought it was menthol. Maltol and
mango.
Mango. Yep. And caramel. And so that's just, those are the food odors. And you're like, well, mango, why does mango reducing, sweetness, granted the error bar is kind of big on that one, but yeah. Mango has a lot of terpenes in it. So if you've ever gotten a good, if you have ever eaten an underripe mango, it tastes like Pine Sol smells. And so that right there can, what I see from that is those terpenes have a negative correlation to our perception of sweetness.
As an aside, I don't have many foods that I don't enjoy, and that's a problem between me and my physician and my scale. But but mango, I cannot eat mango. To me, tastes like I'm eating a bar of soap.
Yep, and you're not alone. I don't have that perception, but I know others that do. But I found that fascinating that we could have that. But then you did the same sweetness thing, right? The same sucrose solution, but you use non-food aromas.
Yeah, you'll have to explain what these non-food aromas were, because it's...
So let me go up to for the blind old man who doesn't have his glasses on. There's a chart up here.
Because in every case, I mean, I can read, well, they're abbreviations, so that's not going to help. In every case, they brought the sweetness perception down.
Correct. So cedral acetate, damascone, angelica oil, acetyl methyl carbonyl. So these are compounds that are found in like vegetation.
Ah, okay.
So like celery or fennel or things like that, where they're not associated with, we would consider sweet, like a strawberry. Mm-hmm. Cedral acetate is cedar, is the active ingredient in cedar oil, cedar essence, or not cedar, cypress.
Huh.
So eucalyptol is in eucalyptus, and lychee is obviously fruit.
Yep.
But
so I think of something like cedar, which has to me a strong aroma, and I wonder, is it just that the sweetness of the taste is being overpowered by a stronger aroma that doesn't mesh with sweetness?
I think it's that what we're testing here is our cognitive associations, mm-hmm. where we're trying to figure out how much influence does aroma have when we smell it. I mean, it's hard to find somebody who doesn't know what strawberry smells like.
True,
right?
True.
And so, what that essence is. So it you wouldn't be able to have a total control group, right, where you could do this against. But I think that's part of the genius here, because you've also got caramel in there. And who doesn't associate caramel with sweetness?
Right. Right. Very true.
Even you, Mr. Barbecue, mm-hmm. right, you're undergoing the Maillard reaction all the time on the grill, and you're caramelizing these sugars that are present in meat. And so that's what also that's part of the whole experience. It's a difference between, barbecuing or grilling meat and boiling it, right?
Mm-hmm. by the way, if you ask my children, tonight I reinvented the concept of the chicken wing.
Oh, did you?
Reinvented. Reinvented. Wow. We had some caramelization going on. Yes.
Ah, nice. So, but we're kind of predisposed to associate some of these stimuli with an experience that we've had just by being alive.
And that gets back to the Krispy Kreme example, the vanilla. Almost anyone, you walk into any bakery and you think, oh, I smell sugar. No, we are predisposed. We smell vanilla. We think sugar.
Right.
We absolutely do. In North America.
Right.
That's not a global thing.
It is not. Definitely not. Certainly if you're in Asia, mm-hmm. where that's just that sort of highly refined sugar sweetness is not part of their culture. I mean, it's been imported mostly through the French cuisine influences, but in their traditional cuisine, you don't see that sort of cane sugar sweetness there. But I like this in this chart. It shows, you know, that every one of those non-food odors, as they call them, showed a suppression. Yeah, there's a couple of them that were like arguably within error of no change. Mm-hmm. But for the most part, they all were negatively correlated.
Yeah, they did. Now why on the next two, lychee and water chestnut? Why are those singled out? Because they are so light on actual flavor?
That's a good question. I don't know why. Why did they choose those?
I mean, water chestnuts have almost no discernible flavor. They have texture.
Right.
And lychee, I mean, usually when you buy them, at least you get them in a syrup, but not in a syrup. They also, I imagine, are just very much devoid of anything specific. I just found it interesting that they would go so specific with the lychee and the water chestnut. But I my suspicion is, again, that it's just that they are not, they're just not fundamentally strong.
And they could also be representations of, like, what I was getting at earlier, which is how many people that tested this would know what lychee smells like.
Oh, so it's a foreign concept.
But yet it's a sweet fruit compared to water chestnut, which is a vegetal, but people wouldn't necessarily wouldn't know what it is. So they're looking at, you know, maybe trying to line up, trying to screen out that cognition part. Mm-hmm.
That makes sense.
That would be my guess.
A foreign but not off-putting scent.
Right. Right. And I remember reading in here somewhere where they're like, yeah, we don't understand why the water chestnut thing showed up sweet because it shouldn't have. But then if you look at the error bars, they're so damn close to no change. I would argue when you dig in the statistics, you're like, are these significantly different? Probably not.
No, I would say probably not.
There is how aroma influences a perception of a physiological trigger that doesn't change its intensity. But it's our perception of intensity. Mm-hmm. It's like saying, I'm going to expose you to the same room, you know, temperature, and give you something to smell, and you tell me whether it's hotter or colder in this room. You're like, well, how would that have anything to do with it? How is whatever you're smelling have anything to do with your perception of temperature? Well, how does anything you're smelling have anything to do with the perception of a physiological trigger on your tongue? Mind blown.
Oh.
So cool.
It is. It is neat, neat stuff. And your mind is just going to go around in circles reading some of this stuff. And so much of it falls right in your wheelhouse if it depends.
The thing with sensory science... Yeah, it does depend. It depends on what there are very, very good studies. Obviously, we're talking about some of them right now that illustrate this. It's almost cognitive dissonance where you're like, wow, it's sort of like we sort of like hack your brain, right? It's like, did we just find a loophole? Oh my God, everyone needs to know about this. but I mean, this happens to us all the time. It happens to us with even our visual input. We have this thing as humans where seeing is believing. Is it? Not really.
No.
Which is why we love, you know, magic tricks and illusion, because seeing is not believing. It can be fooled as well. And I think that's what these research papers are uncovering. They're saying, no, look, your sense of sweet and your sense of sour, because there's a whole other thing in here about Sauer that, you know, I won't spoil that, that people can look at that to say, wow, when presented with a complex mixture of stimuli, depending on what of those individual stimulus are going to do what and how you're going to perceive it can totally change your experience. So per your comment on temperature, where in one of those papers they talked about how temperature, just putting a probe in one's mouth that's heated or not, saying, what's this taste like?
Whenever I do that while we're having dinner as a family, just to get a different flavor out of things, I get really weird looks.
Yeah. Well, Dad, can you keep the probe to the bathroom, please? Mm-hmm. Thank you. Can you put that away? I hope you wash that first.
But then you lose some of the flavor.
Oh, like you do. Yeah, you do. KY jelly. So, I think that if we bring this back to hops, all of this served to illustrate that hops as an odorant or an aroma compound, just let's say it's not made up of 400 things. Let's just say it's a hop and it smells like hops. How it's presented to a beer in the brewing process and how it's presented to your face hole in how it's being served will and does change your cognitive perception and your experience. You know, like on the Discord for you and me or whoever's, you know, Alistair or whoever is talking to us about beer, what do you think about this beer? It's really hard. You know, I'm thinking about all these caveats in my head. And it's like, yeah, I like it. Oh, okay. Well, if James likes it, I'm like, no, I like it in that scenario, in that situation. But I may not like that beer if it gets too warm or if it served flat or if it blah, blah, blah. And so when I say it depends, this is all the kinds of stuff that's running through my head.
Oh, sure.
It's like, how do I want to give people insight into what I'm experiencing, but this is the shit that runs through my head when I'm like doing an aroma analysis.
And you know, I liken it to, I have trouble listening to music without tearing it up because I'm a musician and I hear things, I think, deeper. And sometimes I am envious of people who can just sit back and enjoy music without having to dissect it to little pieces.
Yep. I'm totally there. And I wasn't always like this way. I too used to be like you.
Back in your Miller Genuine Draft days.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. You know, back when J.W. Dundee's Honey Brown Lager was a thing. Pete's Wicked Ale.
Yeah, yeah.
Way back.
This might be the first time we've mentioned Dundee's on the air. We've talked about Pete's.
Yeah. But that was the thing, right? Killian's Red was a big deal.
Yep.
I still find myself enjoying a beer to enjoy it. But you know what I do to do that? I go to those beers that I know to do that. Because I don't feel pressured to analyze it. And there's nobody pressuring me but me.
Right. It makes me feel a little bad for you. I want you to enjoy a new beer.
Most of them just aren't good.
Well yeah, but when you enter into them with that attitude, they're not going to be good.
Oh, I have left the attitude about whether a beer is going to be good or not. You know, I do not. There was a time when I was just like, screw it, I'm not drinking beer anymore because it all sucks. Well, that's not the case, right?
That was at like 4 o'clock this afternoon, wasn't it?
Yeah. I will thank the country of England for restoring my faith in beer. I mean, I'm back, baby. I'm back. But I know, like, if somebody says, hey, James, I know you don't like hazy IPAs, but I want you to try this. What they're saying is they either want me to do a spit take or they want me to analyze it. So what taste this and tell me what you taste. Okay, I will tell you what I taste. And then they usually don't ask me to do that ever again.
Right. Well, we've discussed the fact that I don't like taking you to breweries that I'm fond of because you ruin everything. And even, you know, as I mentioned earlier on this recording, we've been exchanging a little beer lately through the wives, and I'm afraid every time I see you post something that you're trying one of the beers I sent, because God only knows what you're going to do to, you know, I feel like you're going to destroy my childhood.
That's a good one. I have to think about how to, maybe I have to be more harsh. I've been trying to be fair.
No, you've been quite fair. I've been pleased with the reviews. I've been quite pleased.
But I mean, how do you, it is hard to say, yeah, 3 out of 5, right? I mean, it's like, well, James, you bitch about Untappd all the time, and aren't you basically doing the same thing? Well, it's sort of like, well, maybe, but my 3 out of 5 may be a 5 out of 5 for somebody else, because they may think it's the best thing ever.
And it's funny, for all of the different ways that I know you're examining a beer, I think about, I was expecting a 30-point scale. You know, you talk about halo dumping, and it's, you know, 5 isn't enough, but you're using half points too. You're 3.5.
Well, yeah, 3. Yeah, exactly. It's a very infinite decimal point scale. Yeah, significant digits.
I have one last quote here from one of those articles that I have to share, because it kind of takes all this and throws it to the wolves, but I love it. And it's from Mick Burney from 1986. And he says, or she, I don't know, we should resist the categorizing imperative. Our senses did not evolve to satisfy our desire for tidiness. And that is my plea to enjoy a beer. Something smells funny there.